The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power by Robert A. Carroll, Part 3, continued on cassette number 8, side 1. Shelby County, for example, was considered a Dyes stronghold, and the report Shelby County had sent in Saturday night had confirmed that. Out of 2,275 votes reported, Dyes had received 1,040, or 46%, almost as many as the other candidates combined. O'Daniel received 779 votes, or 34%, Johnson 241 votes, or 11%, Mann 215 votes, or 9%. But now Shelby reported 256 additional votes. These were mostly from the same precincts that had reported earlier. But Dyes did not do as well as he had done earlier. He received only 82 of these new votes, not 46%, but 32%. Johnson and Mann didn't do as well either. Mann received 6 votes, or 2%. Johnson did particularly badly. He received 3 of the new votes, 1%. O'Daniel, who had received 34% on the first returns, received 64% on these later returns. 165 out of these last 256 votes, 165 votes to 3 votes for Lyndon Johnson. When Shelby County's new figures were included in the Election Bureau tally, therefore, Johnson's lead was reduced by 162 votes. As Marsh's American Statesman was to comment bitterly, despite the fact that these last votes were from the same county, the same folks who had voted earlier, in this late vote, O'Daniel bettered his rate against Johnson 16 times over. This shift was repeated in Newton County, which now reported 556 additional votes. Dyes again received a smaller percentage of these votes, and again the difference went entirely to O'Daniel. In the late vote from Newton County, therefore, the governor outpolled Johnson 168 to 32. Johnson's lead was reduced by another 136 votes. This abrupt reversal was repeated in the late returns from other East Texas counties. Still other counties from this section had telephoned in complete, if unofficial, returns on Saturday, so that they were now precluded from making substantial changes. But now official, written returns were coming in from these counties by letter or telegram, and many of these written figures were different from the telephoned figures, and the difference was seldom in Johnson's favor. There were 32 less votes for Johnson in Angelina County than had previously been reported, 69 more votes for O'Daniel in Hardin County, 85 more for O'Daniel in Colorado County. County by county, Johnson's lead was being sliced away. Jimmy Allred, presiding over a federal court in New Mexico, telephoned Carol Keach. "I'm listening to the radio," he said. "They're stealing this election in East Texas." Johnson's reaction was to try to steal it back. Telephoning George Parr, he asked the Duke of Duval to give him more votes, but Parr refused. He later told friends that he had replied, "Lyndon, I've been to the federal penitentiary, and I'm not going back for you." Johnson got some corrected totals from various strongholds, 226 from Austin, for example. But he couldn't get enough. His strength was in South Texas, and due to his mistake, South Texas had already sent in its official figures. There was little more South Texas could do. East Texas was going for O'Daniel, and because it hadn't sent in its figures, it could give Pappy whatever he needed. Indeed, as Johnson's effort to improve his total became apparent, his canny opponents held back certain key counties. Trinity County, deep in East Texas, was one, to see what would be needed at the end. Whatever Johnson managed to add, they would be able to add more. Having rushed back to his headquarters from Wirtz's porch, Lyndon Johnson sat all day Monday next to a telephone, and almost every ring brought bad news. It was about noon on Monday that the trend to O'Daniel began. At the time, Johnson's lead was still more than 4,000 votes. Hour by hour, telephone call by telephone call, he had to watch it being sliced away. By 7 p.m., Pappy was less than 1,000 votes behind. But there were only perhaps 5,000 more votes to go, and they had to be divided among 4 candidates. Could he hang on? Late in the evening, a bunch of East Texas counties, Anderson, Cass, Panola, Refugio, Van Zandt, reported their official returns almost simultaneously. When they had finished, Johnson's lead was only 77 votes. There were still more East Texas counties to be heard from. O'Daniel knew what Tuesday was going to bring. When a reporter read him the evening's final figures, the governor smiled and said, Well, that's looking fine. And Johnson knew, too. Walter Jenkins tried to console him by telling him he was still ahead. It's gone, Lyndon Johnson replied. Dan Quill was philosophical. O'Daniel, stole more votes than we did, that's all, he says. But Johnson's frustration and rage erupted over hapless aides. One of them, Dick Waters, was taking his wife out to dinner that night, when, as they were leaving the Stephen F. Austin Hotel, they happened to cross Lyndon's path. Although Waters, a low-level campaign assistant, had had no responsibility or authority for seeing that votes were not changed, Johnson began blaming him for what had happened, screaming and hollering and throwing his arms like Lyndon can do, viciously reviling him in front of his wife. Inside the candidate's suite on the 15th floor, Mary Rather sat, hair disheveled, face wan, trying to muster up a smile for Lady Bird's camera. John Connolly wept. Their premonitions were borne out on Tuesday. Hardly had the Election Bureau office opened when more corrections began coming in. By the end of the day, O'Daniel was more than 1,000 votes ahead. The official final count would give him 175,590 votes to 174,279 for Johnson, a margin of 1,311. Lyndon Johnson's loss had been due to a political fluke. He had been beaten not by his opponent's friends, but by his opponent's foes. O'Daniel had won the Senate seat not because these men wanted him to be senator, but because they didn't want him to be governor, because they wanted to get him out of Texas. But it was Johnson's mistake that had enabled these men to take his victory away. He had planned and schemed and maneuvered for 10 years, had worked for 10 years, worked day and night, weekday and weekend, had done everything. And for 10 years he had won. He had relaxed for one day, and he had lost. Chapter 35. I Want to See Lyndon. After Maury Maverick, Franklin Roosevelt's devoted follower, lost the San Antonio mayoralty in May 1941, the president wrote Maverick's 16-year-old son to console him for his father's defeat. I know he feels badly about it, but I also know, because I know him, that he is quietly sure his point of view will prevail in the long run. The same thing is true about Lyndon Johnson. The things for which he stands will eventually win. He will tell you that, your father will tell you, and I also will tell you. Temporary defeats mean nothing as long as our side wins the last battle. At the moment at which Roosevelt was writing about our side, the side he believed Lyndon Johnson was on, Johnson had already joined the other side, the rabidly anti-New Deal San Antonio City machine that had defeated Maverick. Roosevelt did not know this, and never found out. He never got more than an inkling of Lyndon Johnson's quiet alliance with the New Deal's enemies in Texas. Nonetheless, sympathy for losing politicians, or indeed even tolerance for them, was not one of Franklin D. Roosevelt's most notable qualities. More than one of Roosevelt's Capitol Hill supporters who had been defeated in a try for re-election or for election to the Senate had found after his loss that his previous access to the smiling, genial president had been cut off completely, regardless of the depth and extent of his loyalty to Roosevelt and the New Deal. Among those who had suffered this fate, in fact, was Lyndon Johnson's predecessor in the role of New Deal informant within the Texas delegation, W.D. McFarland. Ousted from his House seat in 1938, despite a personal appearance by Roosevelt on his behalf, he asked the president to keep him in mind for any existing vacancies on the Federal Power Commission, the Federal Communications Commission, or the Federal Bench. Roosevelt kept him in mind for nothing. McFarland received a federal appointment, a temporary low-level appointment as a special assistant attorney general assisting in condemnation proceedings in connection with the Denison Dam, only through the intercession of Sam Rayburn, who did so because McFarland had been one of the old group of populists in the Texas legislature. White House aides were wondering whether Johnson's loss, with such strong Roosevelt backing, had not proven embarrassing to the president, and they were wondering what Roosevelt's reaction would be. They were not kept long in doubt. After his defeat, Lyndon Johnson sent a 2-paragraph note to Franklin Roosevelt. Sir, in the heat of Texas last week, I said I was glad to be called a water carrier, that I would be glad to carry a bucket of water to the Commander-in-Chief any time his thirsty throat or his thirsty soul needed support, for you certainly gave me support nonpareil. One who cannot arise to the leadership shall find the fault in himself, and not in you. Sincerely, Lyndon. In the margin of the note, the hand of Franklin D. Roosevelt wrote, General Watson, I want to see Lyndon. The day after the two men met, Johnson wrote Nan Honeyman, had a visit with the boss today and enjoyed it immensely. The enjoyment was understandable. The president had asked Corcoran what he could do to cheer Lyndon up, and had accepted Corcoran's suggestion. Roosevelt was to address the National Convention of Young Democrats in Lexington, Kentucky, in August. Corcoran suggested that the president put Johnson on the program with him. Roosevelt did so. When Johnson came in to see him, the president told him he had already arranged for him to give a speech preceding his own. The young congressman's defeat had only strengthened Roosevelt's special feeling for him. Despite the defeat, the older man had arranged to give him his first national exposure, the national exposure that he craved. So completely had Roosevelt accepted Johnson's excuse, that he had lost the election only because he had been cheated out of it, that he joked about it, telling him, Lyndon, apparently you Texans haven't learned one of the first things we learned up in New York State. And that is that when the election is over, you have to sit on the ballot boxes. Franklin Roosevelt's greatest service to Lyndon Johnson in connection with the 1941 campaign came not during the campaign, but long after it had ended. In July 1942, while examining the books of Brown and Root, Incorporated, in connection with other matters, Internal Revenue agents became suspicious of the large bonuses to the firm's officials and the various attorney fees, and began following the trail of that money to see where it had ended up, and the trail led to the Lyndon Johnson campaign. Brown and Root, Incorporated, had been advised by tax counsel that campaign contributions by the corporation would not be deductible business expenses. But Brown and Root had deducted hundreds of thousands of dollars in bonuses and fees that IRS agents now suspected were actually disguised contributions. Moreover, while the potential financial liability, payment of additional taxes plus penalties and interest, would be substantial for Brown and Root even at the new level of affluence to which Lyndon Johnson had raised the firm, as the IRS investigation intensified and widened, the dangers were no longer limited to the financial. The agents had begun to wonder if Brown and Root's attempt to avoid taxes by such devices was so blatant that it might constitute an attempt to defraud the government, and tax fraud was a crime that could result in jail terms for those convicted of it. By the autumn of 1942, Brown and Root's officials knew, as one of their attorneys, Edward A. Clark, puts it, that they had big IRS trouble. The man to whose campaign the contributions had been made had trouble, too. Charges involving contributions to his campaign, or even the revelation that charges were being considered, would result in highly damaging publicity. Revelation of the astonishing sums involved, hundreds of thousands of dollars when the Corrupt Practices Act limited the permissible expenditure by a candidate to $25,000, could result in a scandal of dimensions that could end a politician's career. For about 4 months after the investigation began, all concerned felt it could be deflected because of Johnson's White House connections. Brown and Root retained Alvin Wirtz as its attorney on the matter, but even a former Undersecretary of the Interior might have trouble winning this case. It was Johnson on whom the firm was depending. They hired Wirtz for the IRS thing because they knew Johnson would be associate counsel on the case, Clark says. Johnson did not shrink from the role. He was developing a line of strategy to solve the problem. The first step was to convince James H. Rowe, Jr., who was Johnson's liaison to the president, that the Internal Revenue Service investigation of Brown and Root was politically inspired by IRS officials in Texas, loyal to the Garner-Jesse Jones group, and was aimed at cutting off vital Texas financial support for the New Deal. Although this was not true, it was not difficult for so persuasive a talker as Lyndon Johnson to convince men who knew nothing about Texas politics that it was. Rowe, who admired Johnson and believed in him, was thoroughly convinced. During the summer of 1942, he was to recall, I sent to the president a memorandum telling that Internal Revenue agents were going all through Texas stirring up political trouble for our crowd. I sent to the president this memorandum saying that they were after the third-term crowd, who had done the job in Texas, that they were going to all the banks and to the lawyers checking up on political contributions, and that if it wasn't stopped, we wouldn't have a friend left in Texas. Rowe was later to tell Grace Tully that the president had responded to the memorandum. So far as I can determine, and I think it is with accuracy, the president spoke to Marvin McIntyre about it. Mac called John Sullivan, assistant commissioner of the Bureau of Internal Revenue. Rowe assumed that the matter had been closed. But it hadn't. The contributions to the Johnson campaign that were being investigated were too large, the manner in which they had allegedly been concealed too blatant. The next attempt was made with Sullivan's superior, Internal Revenue Commissioner Guy T. Halvering, known to Washington insiders as the President's Man at IRS. Johnson made the attempt himself. He went to Halvering, told him the same story, and asked him to kill the investigation. But this attempt foundered on the invincible integrity of Halvering's superior. Internal Revenue was a bureau in the Department of the Treasury, and the Secretary of the Treasury was Henry Morgenthau, Jr., a man detested by the young wheelers and dealers of the New Deal for his unshakable adherence to the law. The investigation would go right ahead, Morgenthau declared. Now, Rowe recalls, the Browns were worried, and so was Johnson. Johnson, he says, was in trouble, and he knew it. In October 1942, Wirtz and George Brown came to Washington and discussed the situation with Johnson. Then Johnson and Brown talked to Rowe. Johnson and Rowe both realized how thin was the ice they were treading on now. Rowe had been invited to the Washington townhouse Brown and Root maintained at Sheridan Circle. When Rowe learned what the subject of the discussion was to be, he recalls, "I said, I'll talk to you outside on the street. The IRS probably has this house bugged." That is where they talked. Three tall young men, the newly made millionaire, the advisor to presidents, and the future president, standing on a street in Washington. Johnson was worried, Rowe recalls. Reiterating that the investigation was a form of political persecution, a reprisal for his support of Roosevelt, he asked Rowe to take further steps to kill it. Rowe tried. He went to see Halvering himself, and they discussed the matter. "Just the two of us. No, that's not right. He had a witness like those fellas always do. But I said, what the hell, I'll talk anyway." He said Johnson had been to see him to ask him to kill it. "Well, I can't. I would, but the secretary, Morgenthau, won't let me." Rowe had made this approach on my own. Now he knew that a stronger hand was needed. On November 20th, he attempted to bring the subject to the attention of Morgenthau's superior by sending a memo ostensibly addressed to Grace Tully. Halvering has indicated that he can take care of this Texas situation without any trouble, and fairly, but he won't do it if Morgenthau is going to interfere at the last minute. If Halvering gets told by the president to handle it, and if he is backed up, he will do it. Apparently, Morgenthau's superior took an interest in the case. Says Rowe, "Then I, and this I would not have done without Roosevelt's clearance, I went in to see Morgenthau, and I got to thinking, Rowe, you'd better be tactful. Morgenthau taped everything. Everyone knew that. And I just mentioned it, vaguely, just brought it up. I mentioned it to see what he'd say, and he didn't say much. And I just faded out." Morgenthau may not have said much to Rowe, but the secretary may have issued instructions nonetheless. The IRS agents had, some weeks earlier, been ordered by one of Morgenthau's aides to stop working on the Brown and Root case until further notice. On December 17, 1942, shortly after Rowe's approach to Morgenthau, the agent coordinating the case, E.C. Werner, was told to send the Brown and Root file to Washington, which he did by special delivery. Shortly thereafter, Werner and James M. Cooner, special agent in charge of Texas and Louisiana for the IRS, were summoned to Washington to meet with top IRS officials, who, Werner was to write in his diary, "had me explain in detail the fraudulent items and suspicious items." The next day they called him back and gave him his instructions. In Werner's words, "that the investigation was to continue, that it was to be expeditiously but thoroughly conducted, that no outside persons were to be interviewed, but that the investigation was to be conducted from within, that suspicious items found should be brought to his attention, and that we were to be diplomatic in our investigation." Deputy IRS Commissioner Norman D. Cann said that no criticism was being made of any of us. And in 1943, the Internal Revenue Service began to close in on the truth behind the financing of Lyndon Johnson's senatorial race. On January 22nd, the six agents involved held a conference in Dallas and decided on their tactics. Some moved right into the Houston offices of Brown and Root and began checking through the firm's records. Others went to banks and began checking the deposits and withdrawals of some Brown and Root officials. Still others began interviewing these officials and began checking their stories against the records. The largest sums of money the agents were investigating at this point were the bonuses, totaling $150,800, that had been paid to Brown and Root's treasurer and to four of the corporation's vice presidents. These bonuses had, according to an entry in the company's books dated December 27, 1940, been authorized at a meeting on that date. But now the federal agents tracked down a former Brown and Root bookkeeper, Robert C. Horn, and interviewed him at McAllen, Texas. He told the reviewers that despite the date in the books, the bonuses had actually been authorized not in 1940, but in 1941. The agents investigated further. As a result, Werner was to write in a report to his superiors, "Sufficient evidence is on hand, it is believed, to show minutes authorizing above bonuses to be fraudulent." Other smaller bonuses, totaling $24,000, had been paid to lower-ranking Brown and Root executives, the agents found. They obtained transcripts and photostats of the executives' bank accounts, and Werner reported that he and his men were tracing the disposition of this money, that they had already found and taken possession of one check by which $2,500 had been transferred to the Johnson campaign's bank account, and that a substantial portion of the rest of the $24,000 is believed to have been used for Johnson's senatorial campaign. The more they worked on the case, case number SI-19267-F in Internal Revenue Service files, the more questionable transactions they uncovered. Some of the routes by which, the IRS agents believed, the Brown and Root money had reached Lyndon Johnson's headquarters were extremely circuitous. Some of them, in fact, led not from Brown and Root, but from one of its subsidiaries, the Victoria Gravel Company. It had been not Brown and Root, but Victoria Gravel, for example, that had paid a total of $12,500 in attorney's fees to Edgar Monteith, a Houston lawyer. And further steps, they believed, had then been taken to cloud the ultimate destination of the money. $10,000 of it was given by Monteith to his partner, A.W. Baring, as a profit distribution. Then Baring had transferred the $10,000 back to Monteith. And the checks Monteith wrote were not to the Johnson campaign directly, but to pay bills owed by the campaign to radio stations and printers. The remaining $2,500 of the fee paid to Monteith was passed on by him to another attorney, and it was through this attorney that the money reached the campaign. The trail of some of the money was made harder to follow because while it may have started out as checks, it was soon converted into cash. When, for example, J. O. Corwin, Jr. was given a Victoria Gravel check for $5,000, he cashed it, stuck half the bills in an envelope, and mailed the currency to Johnson headquarters. And the agents believed some of the money didn't even start out as checks. It was cash from the start, large expenditures being made from a petty cash fund under the control of Brown and Root Vice President J. M. Dellinger. Attempting to trace the trail of the various Brown and Root contributions, the Internal Revenue Service agents found themselves encountering evasions and denials from Brown and Root officials and from some of the attorneys involved. Lyndon Johnson himself was not questioned at the time, apparently because of the directive from Washington that no outside persons be interviewed. Years later, when the matter threatened to come to light in a series of columns by columnist Drew Pearson, Johnson was asked about campaign contributions made by Monteith, and he flatly denied that he had received any financial help from him. He also said that he had never even heard of Monteith, although, as Pearson noted, Monteith's father was the former mayor of Houston and a well-known personage in Texas political circles. But the agents, digging through corporation and bank records, finding and photostatting checks and campaign bills, were unable to uncover facts that contradicted the denials by the Brown and Root officials and the attorneys. The agents found the checks involved in the various transfers of money revolving around Monteith's attorney's fees, including the checks to pay the campaign expenses. As for Corwin, he was interviewed by an Internal Revenue Service agent about his $5,000 bonus. "Did you use any of it for political donations?" the agent asked him. "Yes, I did," Corwin replied. "To whom?" the agent asked. "Oh, I probably contributed half of it to one of the Lyndon Johnson clubs," Corwin said. "In what form?" Corwin replied that he had mailed it to a Johnson club in Houston, in currency, cash. "And the balance of $2,500, the agent asked. Corwin replied, "Oh, I spent it." But the agents were tracing checks. The $2,500 balance, the agents said, had actually gone to another Brown and Root official, D.G. Young, who was reputedly the corporation's principal contact man with politicians. The money had been transferred by, in Agent Werner's words, a circuitous route. Both Corwin and Young gave false testimony on above item. Another bonus, $2,500, had been paid by Victoria Gravel to Randolph T. Mills. Questioned by Werner, Mills was, Werner reported, very evasive, but Werner finally pinned him down. Question 118. Did you keep them, the money? Yes, I put them in my account. Question 119. And retained them? Well, I didn't retain them very long, no. That is, I paid out, of course. Question 125. Well, you, in other words, the bonus was used by you in connection with your living expenses or obligations, etc.? Well, I wouldn't say all of it was. It was in connection with my living. I gave $2,500 to the campaign, Democratic campaign, of 1941. Mills finally told Werner that he had made out a check, either to chairman, committee, or Johnson, shortly after time of receipt of bonus. He told Werner that he was pretty sure he no longer had the check, but Werner wasn't concerned with that. He had a facsimile of it, made out to one of the campaign's finance directors. The more the Internal Revenue Service team searched, it seemed, the more they found. The transactions of which they were suspicious became larger. Previously, the largest single questionable transaction had been the $45,000 bonus paid to Brown and Root Vice President W.A. Woolsey. Now Werner, checking the account of Brown and Root Treasurer J.T. Duke at the Austin National Bank, came across another check. And this check, made out to Duke by the W.S. Bellows Construction Company, a firm that was part of the Brown and Root-headed consortium building the Corpus Christi Naval Air Station, was for $100,000. And there were increasing indications that cash as well as checks had been involved in large amounts in Brown and Root's expenditures that the agents believed had found their way into Johnson's election efforts. Durst, a Brown and Root official, for example, told an IRS agent that he had cashed his $5,500 bonus checks and kept the money on his person, or hidden it in a drawer of his desk until it was spent on personal expenditures. The IRS, as its investigation continued, was becoming less convinced of the veracity of this account, although Durst insisted that the only donation he might have made to the Johnson campaign was chicken feed, $10 or $15, etc. Then the IRS started asking questions about Vice President Dellinger's petty cash account. Vice President W.A. Woolsey was asked if he would normally receive monies from Dellinger in checks. No, he would give me the cash, Woolsey replied. Did he, Dellinger, have some sort of fund, cash fund? The agent asked. Woolsey first said, well, I don't know, but later said, when the Naval Air Station was first started, I'm sure he kept considerable cash, which Woolsey said was used by top Brown and Root officials. In the margin of his notes on this interview, Werner wrote his conclusion about what he was hearing. Slush fund. In July, the IRS agents began to focus on the $150,800 in bonuses. They arranged interviews with Brown and Root's top officials, and with Herman and George Brown themselves. At these interviews, as many as three agents would be present, in addition to a stenographer to take down the witnesses' replies. Some witnesses were defiant. Asked if he had donated any of his $17,000 bonus to the Johnson campaign, Treasurer Duke replied, no, we didn't make any. Do you think we want to go to the penitentiary by making donations when we have all these federal contracts? Any such allegations, Duke said, were just plain bullshit. But clues as to the disposition of the bonuses were growing nonetheless. On October 23rd, Vice President L.T. Bolin admitted that he had made a cash contribution to Johnson's campaign, although he wasn't sure of the amount. It might have been $500, he said. But he admitted paying for, in an agent's words, some radio time and other things. And the IRS agents determined that Bolin had written two personal checks, for $1,870 for cash, which they found had been given to Johnson headquarters, and for $1,150 to a printing firm for campaign printing. As for the Brown brothers themselves, their answers under questioning were consistent with their personalities. Asked if Brown and Root ever directly or indirectly made any political donations, Suave George smoothly replied, "Insofar as I know, they haven't." Asked again about political donations, he replied, "We've certainly not directed anybody to give campaign funds. We knew it was not legal to give any political funds, and if anybody working for Brown and Root gave any political funds, it was without our knowledge. Certainly I don't think it has been charged to Brown and Root. If it has, it certainly shouldn't have been." Of course, he said, since others had the authority to sign checks, he wouldn't make a sworn statement that nobody has done it. Werner was to write that George personally drew $2,500 from the company, and that while the money was believed paid to Johnson campaign, it had not been traced. As for Herman, fierce and unyielding, who drew $5,000, no notes on his interview can be found, but he apparently made no bones about what had been done with the money. "Admittedly paid to Johnson campaign," Werner wrote. All through October 1943, these interviews went on, and on November 1st, Alvin Wirtz, telegraphing from Houston, asked Roosevelt for an appointment to discuss an important matter at your earliest convenience, supplementing the request with a telegram to Pa Watson. "Only a matter which I think is important to the administration, as well as myself, would impel me to make this request." When he was given an appointment for November 8th, Wirtz specified to Watson that it be off the record. The matter was apparently being raised with Morgenthau again, with the same result as before. On November 2nd, Werner was told by Cooner that he had just received a telephone call from Assistant Secretary of the Treasury Elmer L. Irie in Washington. Irie, Cooner said, had relayed a message from Morgenthau, that the case was to be handled like any other case. And, Cooner said, Irie had added a message of his own, that it appeared fraud was present in the Brown and Root Incorporated case, that if prosecution was in order, then the government would prosecute. Wirtz was unable, for all his persuasiveness, and for all the compelling political reasons on his side, to get Morgenthau's decision overruled by the only man who could overrule it. The most the president would agree to do was, in Wirtz's words, to leave the matter open for further discussion. Further discussion was to be necessary. In compliance with its previous brief, the IRS had thus far not checked outside, but Morgenthau's message now removed those restraints. And in December 1943, the agents took their first steps in this direction. They began trying to find out the identity of the individuals in the Johnson campaign who had received the possibly illicit contributions and what they had done with them. Their first approach on December 6th was to a clerk at headquarters, Mrs. Marguerite Kelly, who didn't know enough to be helpful. Their second, on December 15th, was to Sherman Birdwell. "He told me nothing," Werner wrote after that interview. Their third was no more productive. Herman Brown had said that he had given $5,000 to Walter Bremond of the Capital National Bank. Bremond told Werner he couldn't recall to whom he paid the $5,000. But the agents had scheduled a fourth interview with someone who might have told them quite a lot. He was Wilton Woods, who at college had, on Johnson's advice, dated girls so the White Stars could control them, and had written Johnson's editorials and run his errands, and who had continued to run errands, including the carrying of money, for his idolized chief ever since. Internal Revenue Agent Werner was particularly interested in several items that involved Woods. One was a sum of $1,000, which the IRS agents believed had been given to him by contact man Young on June 14, 1941. Another was the sum of $7,500 which had been given to him by Brown and Root. The IRS's curiosity about this item had been piqued by the fact that this was a rather large sum for the company to hand over to an assistant personnel supervisor, who at the time was earning $225 per month. By the fact that when the Brown and Root official who had signed the check was asked if Woods had done anything around Corpus Christi to earn it, he replied, "I don't believe so." and by the fact that, whatever the expenditure might have been for, Brown and Root had not reported it. The IRS agents believed that the $7,500 was linked to a trip Woods had taken to Washington, D.C. They wanted to know to whom in Washington Woods had given the money, and for what purpose. Woods was scheduled to be the subject of a formal IRS interview, at which his testimony would be recorded, on January 6th. By this time, the stakes involved were huge. With the investigation not nearly complete, the amount by which the IRS team calculated that Brown and Root had underpaid its taxes had already amounted to $1,099,944. Since the IRS penalty where fraud could be shown was 50%, Brown and Root would owe the government an additional $549,972, for a total of $1,649,916. And money was no longer what was most significantly at stake. Irie's conclusion that fraud was present was echoed by Werner, and the penalties for tax fraud as opposed to tax underpayment included jail as well as money. Nor were the potential losses only those of Brown and Root. Lyndon Johnson had a lot to lose, too, not only in terms of career-tarnishing publicity and scandal. Should Herman Brown and his company and some of his employees be found guilty of fraud for the manner in which they had financed Lyndon Johnson's campaign, would Brown be willing to finance other campaigns? Herman's money, Brown and Root money, had been an essential element of Johnson's rise to power, and Johnson was going to need it again. What if it wasn't there for him when he needed it? A new attempt had to be made at the White House, and it was not to be sufficient for Woods to try to make it alone. On Monday, December 27th, Werner was working in Austin, preparing for his interview with Woods. Wirtz was working, too. Roosevelt returned to Washington that day after a weekend in Hyde Park, and Wirtz telephoned the White House and asked for an appointment with the president. The appointment had apparently still not been set up when Woods was interviewed by Werner on January 6th. He was accompanied by attorney Everett Looney. The IRS notes on the interview state that, in re, $7,500 in fees from B&R and Washington, D.C. trip. Woods declined to answer all questions on above fees on advice of counsel on basis that it might incriminate him. He gave the same answer to the IRS inquiries about the $1,000 fee, and when Werner notes he was given opportunity to tell of any other unreported receipts, Woods again declined to answer on grounds that might incriminate him, although he did say that at time of preparation of return he thought it was true and correct. And on January 11, 1944, Lyndon Johnson telephoned the White House and asked for an appointment with President Roosevelt. The secretary who took the message for Pa Watson wrote Watson that Johnson is very anxious to see the president as quickly as he possibly could. He says it is not a Sunday school proposition. Lyndon Johnson and Alvin Wirtz saw President Roosevelt on January 13, 1944, at 11:50 a.m. At 4:30 that afternoon, Elmer Irie telephoned Texas. He had been ordered to be at the White House at 10 o'clock the next morning to give a full report to the president on the income tax investigation into Brown and Root Incorporated, he said. Irie asked Werner to send him, in time for his meeting with the president, detailed information on political payments made by Brown and Root Incorporated to the Lyndon Johnson 1941 senatorial campaign. So that the information would reach him before he had to leave for the White House, he asked that it be sent over the government teletype in the Houston office of the Bureau of Narcotics. The report was unequivocal. After listing the $150,800 in bonuses, for example, Werner stated, "Sufficient evidence is on hand, it is believed, to show minutes authorizing above bonuses to be fraudulent." Then the report listed specific drawings against those bonuses which had been traced directly to the Johnson campaign. The $2,500 from Randolph Mills, for example, or the $2,500 which Corwin admits was donated to the campaign, together with what the IRS team believed was sufficient evidence to prove the case. Of the Mills bonus, for example, Werner wrote, "Admitted by Mills. We trace to Johnson bank account and have Record Act facsimile of check." But the opinion of the six agents who had been working on the Brown and Root investigation for 18 months was not to carry much weight in its ultimate disposition. Johnson and Wirtz had seen Roosevelt on January 13th. On that day, a new agent, who had no previous knowledge of the case, was sent to Texas from the IRS Bureau in Atlanta, Georgia, to make a separate investigation of it. Arriving in Texas on January 17th, this new agent began studying the case. He proved to be a quick study indeed. 3 days later, he told Werner, "The case as it now stands does not have quite enough evidence, in my opinion, for the chief counsel's office to pass it for prosecution, but there is ample to sustain the 50% penalty." The next day he confirmed this, adding that, as Werner put it in his diary, he would recommend against making a prosecution case in view of Brown and Root Incorporated's participation in the war effort. Then he left for Washington, D.C. The Georgia agent had also told the Texas agents that he could see no reason why we should not be permitted to finish our investigation of certain unfinished work, which we had detailed to him. But this work was, in fact, never to be finished. On February 15th, IRS Chief of Intelligence W.H. Wolf told Cooner that it had been decided, based on the facts now in hand, that there was insufficient evidence on the Brown and Root Incorporated case to sustain criminal prosecution, and that the likelihood of developing proof adequate for that purpose is too remote to justify further extension of the investigation. The Texas agents were ordered to submit final reports on the basis of the facts now in hand. Agents who had actually been working on the case felt that the facts now in hand only scratched its surface. Because of the earlier orders that no outside persons were to be interviewed, they had been restricted until recently to interviewing Brown and Root officials. Only within the past few months had they begun talking to members of the organization that had received the questionable contributions, the Johnson campaign. In fact, they had talked only to a handful of campaign aides, all low level. They had not talked to the campaign's higher ups. Wirtz, for example. They had not talked to the candidate. They did not agree with the Georgia agent's conclusion that the facts now in hand were insufficient for prosecution, but even if he were correct, they felt that if they were allowed to investigate the link between Brown and Root and the Johnson campaign thoroughly, much new evidence would be developed. Werner asked, apparently on behalf of the rest of the team, to be allowed to continue the investigation. On March 2nd, he received his answer. He was ordered to drop the case, at once and forever. A letter from Chief of Intelligence Wolf reiterated that the case was to be reported by the examining agents on the basis of facts now in hand, with a view to placing the case in line for disposition under routine field procedure. A further extension of the investigation, as proposed by Special Agent Werner, will be inconsistent with this finding, and it is accordingly directed that the case be disposed of as indicated above. On June 28th, Werner submitted his final report on case SI-19267-F, showing tax deficiencies of $1,099,944 and a penalty of $549,972. But even this was to be scaled down. After a series of further conferences between IRS officials and Wirtz, Brown and Root was ultimately required to pay a total of only $372,000. There were, of course, no fraud indictments, no trial, no publicity. Franklin Roosevelt had already done so much to advance Lyndon Johnson's career. In this instance, it may be he who saved it. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.